Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And I am Mujan Sohi. I'm the founder of Rivera.
Well, welcome, Mujan. And what is Rivera so that people know what that is real quick?
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Rivera is a reliability and failure analysis engineering consulting company. I help hardware companies solve reliability issues and hopefully make their products more reliable and root cause any issues that they may have.
Cool. We'll get into all those topics at one point or another. And thanks for, you know, joining us as a co-host on the podcast. We talked a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago, and I said, you should be a co-host on the show. And hopefully everybody that's listening will understand why. Now, just before we got on air, we were chatting about, well, what do we want to talk about? And I found it interesting you went to ChatGPT, and is part of why I wanted to invite you on it, because you do stuff different than I do, which is perfect. It's always a good thing. Yet I'm not planning my own obsolescence, which we titled this episode at. But if you want to take over, that'd be great. But have you run into that? One of the questions I had in my mind when I was thinking about what to talk about when we were just chatting is, oftentimes in a product development process, you want to set a reliability goal, like it's going to last certain percent, will survive 5 years or whatever duration it is. And usually a warranty period is of interest and things like that. Yet my laptop will not update to the latest operating system. It's no longer supported. And it could be a hardware issue. It could be whatever the reason is. And it's, I think, about 8 years old now, the laptop. And it's not unexpected. I know that our electronics for hard phones and computers and tablets and stuff will eventually time out. Nobody is loading Microsoft Windows 3.1 anymore. At least I hope not. But how do you go about dealing with setting, you know, reliability expectations when you know that there's going to be a timeout or a dropping of the spare parts and servicing and support and stuff like that? And I think you had a couple other thoughts on it too, but I'm just curious how you deal with it when you know you're going to drop the product.
Yeah, it's a great question and it's a great topic. Actually, it's funny you say that because my laptop is the same. I was just thinking, it's at some point soon, I think I need to get a new laptop, because I believe this is also probably 6 or 8 years old. And I did just get the notification for that Windows is no longer going to update on this laptop. So it's very much the same boat. And yes, it's a question that companies have to think about, certainly when they are going through product development. It's impactful in so many ways, because it can impact sustainability. It can impact cost, of course. It can impact, you know, your whole product development time cycle and, you know, what details in development and design you're going to consider. What I had, as I was thinking about this and also brainstorming a bit with ChatGPT, the sustainability part was one that it was a bit more into in my thoughts, and you know, I went deeper into with ChatGPT. One of the ways that it's so important, because one, it's at the forefront of the product development thought process and cycle, and so many different companies these days, as they're trying to build their new products, you know, sustainability is the key factor that is considered.
But let's expand that a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking, when I think of sustainability, it's the environmental impact type stuff. And for example, a number of years ago, the European Union passed a law saying your product, we have to divert it away from landfills. You have to recycle it, or you have to do all these other things, and at its end of life. And I think there's even a state law in Minnesota that says if you ship a wooden pallet or any pallet into our state, you have to take it back. we're not going to put it in our landfill, stuff like that. Is that what you mean by sustainability in that realm of it?
Yeah, it's a very good point. It can mean a lot of things. Like, I think it's, you know, it's part of it is end of life, like you said, like end of life of a product is important. Part of it is just generally carbon footprint, which takes into account, you know, end of life and reusability. Mm-hmm. And part of it is what is going into your product, especially, in hardware products, you know, literally what materials are you using?
Like lithium.
Yes.
Ion batteries.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Very important component. and it's you know, do you have a target? I think it all really kind of comes back to product definition. And as you're thinking about product definition, what are your requirements? And do you plan for those? How do you plan accordingly?
I imagine, you know, companies without 8 or 10 years of generational, you know, every year launching a new product, as some big companies do, they have to think about it. And part of the equation is, well, how many people are still using the older operating systems or the older hardware and so on? And then eventually they're going to figure out that, you know, there's still a million people using Microsoft 3.1. I guess we better keep supporting it. Whereas I've heard of other people look at it going, no, we're going to sell you a new laptop every year. It's like fashion. You have to have the latest whatever. And that puts a lot of strain on that sustainability aspect of it. And I have a perfectly good working laptop, although I'm not using it right now because its ability to connect to my network is not working. So it gets a really, really low speed on it. It wouldn't work for recording. So I think something's wrong with it, yet fixing that may take a couple of hours and maybe $100, whereas buying a new laptop is $1,000, $2,000. And I'm like, and now I have if for $100, I can get it back to full speed and the electronics are still fine. It'll probably work for another 5-10 years. Mm-hmm. So from my point of view, I know one guy that still has his iPhone 6. And what are we on? 14, 15, I think now? 16?
My phone is old and it's a 13. So I think
record. Yeah. He went in and had the battery replaced because it wasn't holding a charge very long anymore. And he says it's as good as new. I can't load any new games on it. Can't do anything, any updates to apps or anything. Yet for a calendar, for GPS support, for the maps function, and a handful of others that he uses for. And he said it actually makes phone calls just fine.
That's wonderful. That's good to know. I didn't even know it makes sense didn't even cross my mind that I should go and just have the battery in my phone replaced, because that would be great. because I really, really like my phone. It's actually the 13 mini was as far as I understand, is the last small phone that they made. They're all getting larger now.
It's sort of like the auto industry is, you know, we used to have nice little cars and now they're all getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But the idea, though, is that you're right, is that the company has to think about it, and it's not just a reliability issue. Yet if you know that you're going to suspend support for it at, say, 10 years or whatever the time frame is, well, then part of the design criteria is that it should really last for 10 years without too much problem. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, even though it's well beyond the warranty period, it may affect people buying the extended warranties, that kind of thought process, and they may make money doing it that. Yet I think you also brought up a point where I hadn't never thought of, is the cost of customer support is built into the price of the unit. And mm-hmm. So if they know they have to support it for 10 years versus the expected 5 years, they have to charge more to cover the extended cost of those services, of carrying spare parts. All those things cost money, and it has to be factored into the prices. And so I'm like, there's a lot more to it. Yet all too often, especially with consumer products, I see 3 points that people will set a goal for, is like, what's the out-of-box experience? How good does it have to be the first day to use, the first month or whatever? Warranty is an easy, obvious one. Most companies understand that as a spot to make a target. And then some will go out to, well, how long do we think the product will be used, the useful life? And if you have a planned obsolescence one, well, that seems to be good for the people that first buy the product. But if you're one of the last buyers of that product version or model, you get cheated because
you don't have as much support. Yeah. Like you're going to, the support timeline for you is just shorter relative right. to others. Yeah.
We should get a discount if we buy it late. Where's that idea? Negotiate that.
There you go.
But the idea is that it is a business practice and it does occur in all kinds of different industries and different places. Some, like when I worked with Hewlett Packard, we had test and measurement equipment. Its design life was 10 to 15 years, yet we knew of some of the products that were used for 20, 25 years because of the price point and the feature set it had was pretty mature, and it just worked. So there wasn't any reason to replace it with anything else. So the emphasis on planned obsolescence was pretty minimal because if you create a product that provides value way into the future, there's no reason for a customer to purchase a new one. And you just have to build a business model that accommodates that.
Do you think that was it ever tracked for how, I mean, the 25-year data, for example, that came from somewhere, right? So, so do you know, for example, what percentage of the population of the product was still being used by that time?
I got a phone call. You know how these calls go. They're like on a Friday afternoon.
Yes.
And it was a company out of Japan that did wafer fabrication type stuff in big clean room. And they said, we've had a failure of one of your terminals. And this is after terminals were a thing of the past, a central computer with terminals as separate entities. And there were a handful of them on their production floor. And one of them, he described it as one of the resistors smoked. So it basically overheated and destroyed itself. And in a clean room, it's not a good place to have any smoke from any electronics or anything else.
Yes.
And so they have to shut everything down, clean everything, do that stuff. So it cost them millions and millions of dollars for a fraction of a cent resistor to fail. The product was in their plant for 15 years. And terminals, that division, I looked into it for this guy, and that division had suspended all production 10 years prior. And he was asking me to track down what was the serial number or the batch that was used on this serial number of product, this terminal, and what other units have that same reel from the same reel or same production line of resistors. I don't know anybody wow. keeps track of details like that on any level, but I'm sure somebody does. Yet I said, I'm sorry to say, but that division closed down 10 years ago and all of their records have been, you know, disposed of and their legal documents and all those things are still around, but none of their production records are around. And he wasn't happy with that answer yet. I knew it was 15 years. So then I went in and somebody asked me, why are they still using that? And I said, well, in my last job, I had an HP, it was like HP had such clever names for their products. It was probably something like 8610A or some creative and captivating like that. and it was just a small computer. It had a cash register tape roll was the output. And had a keyboard, and we had a program on it that measured the resistivity of a sample of the product we were making and set the timing on this because it was a temperature sensitive measurement. And I took it in to get refurbished and updated because it wasn't quite printing quite cleanly. I think it had a bent pin is why I took it in. And it was definitely not an inkjet. It was, what do they call it when it's a bunch of like 9 or 10 pins that push down on some ink onto the paper?
Yeah, I know which ones you're talking about. I forget what they're called.
You're in museums now.
Yeah.
And And the guy from HV Service Center came around the corner and he says, I have to meet you. He says, I have never seen a computer come in this condition. I said, what do you mean? And he held up a great big sack full of carbon black. Their plant used carbon black to dope polymers to have a feature that we wanted. And he said, this thing was absolutely jam-packed with this black powder. And I said, and he asked, what is it? And I said, it's carbon black. It'll kill you in the state of California. But, you know, other than that, it's pencil lead.
And
as a complete aside, I was the safety officer of that factory for a while, and the state of California and their chemicals known to cause cancer, you mm-hmm. see everywhere.
Yes.
Carbon, the letter C was on that list.
I think everything is on that list.
Pretty much. Yeah, definitely.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. So anyway, I told him what it was, and he goes, this was absolutely jam-packed in here. You couldn't get any more into it. And it still didn't overheat, didn't do anything. And he says, where do you use this? And I explained it. And he goes, I haven't seen one of these in years and years and years. And I said, we have a whole closet full of them because we can't figure out how to replicate this program that this computer does for us. It was a timing issue with everything else we tried. And so anyway, that one was in service for at least 20 years.
Amazing.
So those are anecdotal. I know in like Tesla with their telemetry that comes off their cars, they're going to have great data for that kind of stuff. Yet you still see, I saw a Mustang on the road yesterday, and it probably still has its original 1965 push button radio on it. It probably works just fine.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so the thing that I've always wondered about is where, you know, how do you distinguish between over-engineering? At what point becomes over-engineered? Is it over-engineered? Is it meeting, you know, like, cause you can design life of 10 years, I agree, is typical, right? Like you said, the mm-hmm. design life for 10 years. And in all my career, that's what I've used. I've used design life of typically about 10 years. I guess, mm-hmm. you know, consumer electronics is lower, but for cars, it's 10 years. But it becomes a balance of at some point, if you want to make it last longer, you do have to put in more effort into the reliability of the product, which will probably cost more, right, in terms of development. Maybe, you know, in some cases it can, and in clever ways it wouldn't. You want also to be able to, it's at some point customers are also going to be like, well, I want a new product.
Right. I like a 800 megapixel camera. Not that I can tell the difference between a 30 and 35 megapixel, but.
Yes. So I've always thought that it becomes like an optimization problem at some point, because you want the you want to figure out at one point does it make sense for the product to become go to aftermarket, let's say, you know, mm-hmm. for cases you can have aftermarket parts while still, you know, providing function and but also you need to obviously build a product that lasts long enough also. I've always wondered like whether at some point does it become over-engineered, or is there no such thing as you know, like over-engineering for cases like that?
Well, if you make hot swappable batteries for phones, that means you have to have two batteries in there as a minimum. And do we really need that? It's what's the functionality, what's the consequence mm-hmm. of downtime, all that stuff. If I'm putting a robot on a production line, I don't want it going down at all. And so there'll be redundancies and degraded operations. And it really depends on the functionality. Yet there's a lot of drivers for why things go obsolete. Some is, oh, that's really not useful anymore. I want something bigger, faster, better, cheaper, solves the problem in an easier way, something like that. And other times it's, we want you to buy another product. We're just not going to support it anymore. And we're going to kick you off the trailing edge of not updating it as we, you know, go along.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how many ads I get from phone companies and computer companies that saying, hey, you know, trade it in, you know, upgrade, do this, do that, get the new shiny thing. then I gutted my 2000 Tacoma or Toyota Tacoma small pickup truck and go, yeah, it still works. It works just fine. Thank you. But anyway, that might be just me. But I think we could talk about this in a whole bunch of different aspects of it. I think the sustainability aspect of it is getting, the European Union was the lead on this, and I was really hoping it would get more traction ever around the world. And I imagine it will as we go. We're just running out of copper. We're running out of raw materials to make stuff. We just really can't afford to just throw it away. And I think that's going to be the driving force for electronics can last a long, long, long time. And mechanical systems that are moving do have wear. If they're designed well, then it's not a big deal. You can make it last. There's some factories with gearboxes that have been running for 50 years. So it can be done.
Yes, it can be done. Yes, I totally agree. And I think one of the things that I've always been fascinated by is in what other ways, in addition to engineering and reliability engineering, mechanical engineering, et cetera, can you improve, maybe not 100% solve, but can you improve this problem? There's a really fantastic, I think very fascinating TED talk by an advertising person. His name is Rory Sutherland, from many years ago, I still go back and watch it once in a while. It's a wonderful talk. Where he talks about how we tend to dominate, think in such a way, like engineering solutions tend to dominate, problem solving in general, where you want to think of a practical engineering solution for something that maybe can be solved with perception. And my favorite example from this that he talks about in the TED Talk is he talks about how there was a bid to improve the train trip between London and Paris.
Okay.
And many engineering companies bid on it, and several, came in and said, okay, we can spend, a few billion pounds and improve the train ride. I think the best one, if I recall correctly from his talk, he was saying was shortening the trip by 45 minutes. And he says, he's like, communist or picky, but I think shortening a trip is a kind of an unimaginative way of trying to improve something, improve a trip. You could take half of that money, hire supermodels to walk up and down the train, handing people champagne, and people will happily stay on the train for longer. That was so fascinating to me. I just, as someone who is very much in the business of trying to improve the life of something, right? And the life of something can be anything, really. It was like a light bulb moment to me. And I was like, whoa, wait, there's this whole other way of trying to solve problems that I don't think as engineers we tap into this resource as much. And one of the relevant kind of to this topic of obsolescence and sustainability that I've thought about a lot is, at these, hardware development companies, there's this obvious and natural and understandable tendency to, you want to build this perfect product, right? You want it to be, you want to have the perfect texture, the color, the material, you want it to obviously look nice. You want it to obviously function. It has to function well. Obviously, it has to meet all your requirements and your standards. But the people who, myself included, who set these standards, who decide what these requirements are, we have a pretty high bar. We've been trained by the best, and we have a good eye for, whether you're an industrial designer or a reliability engineer or a mechanical engineer, you want to build a really excellent product. And so we have a high bar. And my thought was always, when you're trying to think about sustainability, one of the things that immediately comes to mind whenever we're working on these problems is we want to, let's say, for instance, increase the recycled content of your polymers for some components, whether it's for a phone or a laptop or, interior of a car. And immediately there's hits. Anyone that's worked on this would be familiar, but there could be hits on your cosmetics. It could be hits on your mechanical properties. Yep. And there's always this chicken and egg situation where you're like, but I want more recycled content because I want the carbon footprint to be reduced. And but I also want it to like last longer, and I want it to be, you know, I want it to look perfect and function perfectly. And there's always this balance. And I, after thinking about this so much with the, you know, and reading more about what Rory Sutherland talks about, I keep thinking, is there a way where we can not have it be perfect? Can we do this and convince the customer that it's okay? Because there's a benefit to, you know, it's a trade-off. Yes, maybe it has, you know, the texture is not as perfect and there's flakes on it and it looks weird. You know, it's not, you know, my laptop that's sitting in front of me right now is black and it has this very nice like matte texture. And I remember when I got it, I was like, oh, this is awesome. Like it feels so cool and it looks so great. But what if I knew when I was buying it that it's not going to look perfect and it could have these flakes on it and it could look weird, but it reduced the carbon footprint of the product, you know, during its development by some percent.
Mm-hmm.
How would that impact my you know, decision making and for buying it from a consumer perspective?
That might be another whole topic for us to dive into. I'm thinking, but the idea, and I just wrote down the title of one, would be good enough reliability, because every time we design anything, it's a trade-off. Design for sustainability is this one of the many design for something campaigns that design teams have to deal with. And then we walk in and say, oh, by the way, make sure it's reliable enough too. And well, everything else can be measured right off the bat, whereas it's really hard. We get the challenge of, well, how do you measure how reliable it's going to be when it's 10, 15, 20 years out and the impact of that. But anyway, before we get obsoleted off the air here, I didn't note what time we started, so I think we went a little long, but that's all right. It happens. But we've covered a whole slew of different topics here, and I mean, the sustainability part, business models, what's technically feasible, the features that force people to move to the next generation. I really don't have an answer for how many people still use iPhone 6s, although I bet you Apple does, because they know how many people are still connecting and using their phone in one form or another. So there's probably ways to get estimates for stuff like that. Yet it's not a simple, it's a problem that in reliability engineering, we need to be aware of. And how long is this product really need to work well? And it may well be well beyond what you think of as the useful life or the warranty period, stuff like that. And so we need to be conscious of that and what kind of spares we need, what kind of service we need, stuff like that, which isn't commonly done during the design period. All too often.
Yes, I totally agree. I always challenged when someone came to me and said it has to meet this specification, I needed to be convinced. So I was always like, why? I mean, I'm not saying it shouldn't. It just let's talk about why. Well,
we got to prioritize it. Yeah, you got to prioritize it so you can do the right trade-offs, because you're not going to get everything. Sorry, marketing team. You're just not.
Yes, exactly. You're not going to get everything. So there has to be a trade-off. So let's figure out why we're deciding behind, you know, these specifications and figure out, to your point, what's the most important.
Yep. So let's wrap it up there. And just, you know, if you're listening to this and if your head's nodding one way or the other, let us know. If we're on the right track with thinking through this, and we missed a couple of spots, which I'm quite sure we did because it's a big topic, you let us know. We'll put it on the list for future topics to talk about. You can do that a couple of different ways. Over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, you can find a way to leave a voice message for us and get your voice actually in the conversation with us. Or you can leave us a text message type thing, a contact form. Mujan and I and the other hosts of the show are available through LinkedIn and our about pages. So there's plenty of ways for you to get in touch with us. And we'd love to hear your comments and thoughts on this episode or on other topics on your mind. And with that, and I'm second guessing myself, am I pronouncing your name right?
Mujan.
Okay.
Yeah, you got it.
Give me a couple of years, I'll get it.
I know.
And Well, thanks for joining us as on the show, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you for having me. Yeah, it's wonderful.
All right, cool. Well, thanks much. We'll talk to you later.
Yeah, take care.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.